don't want to be overextended so far that you have only debt to your name and no assets. So it's okay to have some cash on hand. It might take some time to build that up, and it might mean that you're expanding slower than a competitor or slower than you would like to, but you want to have some sort of protection so that you are not completely gutted when something like this happens. The food supply chain. That's what we're talking about today. This is a special 10th of May episode of the Food Service Distribution Podcast. It's Mother's Day. If you haven't called your mom yet, do it now. It's getting late. We're going to talk about the food supply chain because that is the topic on everybody's minds. There has been a lot of discussion over whether there is a shortage or an excess in food and food supplies and materials in all different areas of the supply chain, all the different nodes. And a lot of people are looking at this like, am I going to be able to source food when I source proteins and produce and certain specialty foods? Are they going to be available? Are they going to be very expensive? And the questions that you should really be asking is, what is the food supply chain? Why when something happens at the farming level, does it affect retail? Or why in the processing level, when processing plants go down, why does it affect the farmers? So I'm going to try to explain it in a few easy steps. I've divided it into four areas, and it should be pretty easy. So I'm going to try to answer what's going on, why people are saying it's broken, and then walk through the supply chain to in the food service industry specifically, and give you guys a idea of what it's all about and what might be next in the pipeline. All right. So what is where did this all come from? Where is this news getting stirred up that there's breakages in the supply chain? We've seen a very unique situation with farmers all over the country and all over the globe where they're unable to find processing facilities for their raw product. So manufacturers and farmers create the raw product before it goes on to the next step. That's just the cattle, the livestock, the chickens, lettuce, tomatoes, anything that is not processed to be purchased in a store or by a consumer. That's what the first step is. That's what the manufacturers and farmers do. So they've had to dump milk, they've had to destroy crops, they've had to euthanize their livestock in some of the worst case scenarios. And there was a lot of question, there has been a lot of question over why this is happening. So in a few easy, few quick steps, I'm just going to go through, there was an initial sharp increase in demand. That came about because of the pandemic scare. People were rushing to the stores, getting all the toilet paper and all the frozen proteins and chicken and everything that you can think of that you would need on a indefinite lockdown. That's what people were going and stocking up on. Okay, so number two is each of these manufacturers and processors, so something's manufactured and then it gets processed, they all have, outside of just specialized knowledge, they have specialized equipment, okay? And they have packaging specific to the items that they are processing. So when you see something like, we'll take the toilet paper, that's a really good example, something like there's a shortage of toilet paper all over the country. But at the same time, there are big companies like Georgia-Pacific that are mass producing major amounts of toilet paper for retail customers and restaurants and office buildings that are all consumers think that you can go and dip into that stock of toilet paper and put that in stores, or that they should be able to just switch production from the 2-ply 500 sheet toilet paper that you have in your closet, that you can move from producing these commercial size giant jumbo toilet papers, that they could just flip the switch at the processing plant and start producing the smaller rolls. They can't. They're two different pieces of machine. It's different types of the initial before it becomes the paper. So it's a step past the pulp part of the process. But I'm not going to get into the breakdown of how toilet paper is made. I don't fully know that. So that'll be a different video. All right. So the specialized equipment and the specialized packaging, you can't just flip a switch and have production plants that are specialized in one thing switch over to something else. We're seeing that a lot with automakers using their space to do PPE, personal protection equipment, making masks and things like that. Okay. So it's very challenging for them. All right. So number three is for why this happened is restaurants closed. And that was a government order. Okay. So the restaurants are closing. That's causing same thing as number two. You see the demand for the type of product that would be sold into a restaurant and just completely zero out. So the demand for that same product or raw product, so the same turkey or eggs or chicken or lettuce that are served in bigger pack sizes in restaurants, those can't be just sold directly to groceries and then consumers come and pick up a 50-pound bag of rice. It doesn't work like that. So the pack sizes are all different. And the restaurants being closed added to the complication. Number four, processing plants being closed. And that's due to positive cases of the coronavirus. And we're seeing in certain areas, the way that we have set up the supply chain, and this is kind of why it's so fragile and why people are saying that it's broken or that it's breaking. These individual nodes or these individual processing plants that are in the supply chain are further and further apart, and they specialized in mass producing a specific item. So when one shuts down, if there's positive cases of the coronavirus and they end up shutting down for any amount of time, that puts that much more pressure on the other nodes or the other units that are processing the same supplies that are further apart. When you get into a situation that everything is manufactured in one plant or out of the country, that just compounds the issues and it becomes a massive problem. All right, so the last thing that kind of leads into is this global interdependence of that we have in the food supply chain. We depend on so many other countries, so many individuals that are far away from where you are as a consumer, to be 50% or 60% or even 100% of the production on that specific item. So when product is not able to come over borders or come over borders as efficiently, you're going to have huge problems. So those are the five steps five pieces that I wanted to touch on and kind of what is happening and why we've gotten to this situation where people are making these statements that the supply chain is breaking. So what you need to remember is that the food supply chain that we have today is very different from what it's looked like in the past. It's always been much more regionalized and everything or localized. And everything that we do now is built with purely with efficiencies and profitability in mind, which is not a bad thing. Profitability is not bad, efficiency is not bad, but when you put 100% of your eggs in one basket or from one farmer and something happens to that farmer, you have major problems. So before we got to where we are today, throughout history, if you wanted to get product, or just take this example, if you consumed something, there was a 100% chance that something that you are eating and consuming was grown and harvested and processed, distributed, purchased, and consumed all within the same town or the same region at least. And through us needing to maximize those efficiencies and that profitability, and just seeing that we can expand the supply chain and take advantage of market costs in different markets, we have really done a number on our ability to be flexible when one of those nodes goes down. So today, when you're eating something, you go to the closest by restaurant and you order something off the menu. Chances are that there are going to be ingredients from that one dish that is going to be sourced in your state, in another state, in another region, and maybe even another country. Right, so a good example of that would be tomatoes, depending on the time of year. All of our tomatoes here on the West Coast are going to come from California or Mexico. And from probably the November to January period, all of that product is coming from Mexico. And if you're on the East Coast, a lot of it comes from Florida. But even this last year, we had a major spike in tomato prices because some of the farmers decided to opt out of tomatoes and opted into another crop. And we had tariffs on tomatoes coming up from Mexico. The USDA was really looking at trying to make sure they were up to a certain standard. And some of them even got turned around if they didn't meet the quality qualifications of the USDA for tomatoes coming into the country. So a lot of farmers in Mexico just decided, we're not going to go bring a load up to the border to get it turned around. We're just going to sell it locally here and we'll let somebody else bring it up to the United States and see if they get turned around. So there are all sorts of complications with needing to export or import all of your goods. But at the same time, you know, this is what we do as human beings. We try to find efficiencies and we try to find a way to make more profit. So an important thing to note on that also is why we've gone towards that route of looking for the most efficiencies is food is perishable. All food is perishable. And unless it is, pumped with preservatives and put in a can, chances are you're going to get 5 to 6 days with some produce items or 1 to 2 weeks with some poultry or some proteins, depending on how you store it from the moment that it is harvested or slaughtered or picked from the ground. On lettuce, we try to get lettuce picked from the ground in Salinas or in the Central Valley in California and to the customer and consumed within 4 to 5 days. That's efficient. And that is the goal. That's the target that we always try to hit. So to have that type of a requirement, a personal standard of ours or of my companies and of our customers, to do that effectively all the time consistently is challenging, but we've set up the system so that it's possible, which would make it very, very challenging if, knock on wood, the specific tomato grower or transporter or processor or repacker, if anything happened at that point, even when a truck breaks down, it's catastrophic and it's not fun. All right. So another thing that we really need to think about is costs associated with slow items. Okay. So this is kind of breaking down why the supply chain is built up to the point that it is right now. Is there is a cost associated to slower moving items, meaning if you have something sitting on the shelves of a warehouse and it sells in 2 days. So you bring it in, it sells in 2 days. It's in and out very quickly. It's the term that's being used there would be a just-in-time program. So it's brought in and sold very quickly. You compare that and the cost of that and the total overhead of that item to something that sits on the shelves for 90 days. And that might be a imported toy that goes along with a kid's meal or maybe cups and lids, something that's not going to move as much. Not a lot of people think of this, but when you have an item that's sitting on the shelves of a warehouse for 90 days, 120 days, you have to also tie the cost associated with the utilities, the rent on the building or the mortgage, the interest on that, the labor, the security guard that watches the place at night, all of those components. And it's not something that is commonly thought of, but there is a cost associated to all of that that you need to add to those items that are sitting on the shelf for 3 or 4 months, because the cost of having it sit there increases substantially because it's taking up prime real estate, but you are not able to pass on that cost to the customer. You're not able to increase the amount of gross profit you get on that, or you can't increase revenue. You can only increase the cost of that item, okay? So something that not a lot of people think about. And that's why we are incentivized and redistributors are incentivized and restaurants are incentivized to not have items in their in the finite real estate they call their walk-in cooler. So you want to have a quick turn on all of that product. And that just leads to more of the problem. But that's the business that we're in. And that's what the nature of food and food service items is that you want to turn it quicker. You're incentivized to do that. Okay, now we've reached the fun part, and that is, how does a food supply chain work? What is the flow through? How do you get a seed to a tomato on your sandwich, right? This is what we're going to do. I'm going to break down the four basic components. There are many more components than that. I'm leaving off the consumer at the end, and I'm leaving some other stuff out, but I think that from my perspective, there are four main pieces to focus on. And I'm going to draw on my whiteboard a little example, a little diagram of how this stuff flows through also. We're going to start with production. So production would be the farmers or the manufacturers. And that is the very beginning and how you get the raw product. Okay, so the product that will eventually be something that is sellable to a retailer or sellable to a restaurant. But it has to start somewhere. It starts with the farmer and the manufacturer. So that would be seeds and fertilizer and soil. or livestock and the feed, the food that the livestock is going to eat, the land, of course. And there are so many components just in the beginning phase where you have the manufacturing process. You have to have specialized equipment. You have to have, usually you have to have some sort of financing. If you do not own the property outright, then there's relationships with banks and you have to borrow. And especially in this situation of this pandemic, there are entire crops that have had to be thrown away or absolutely devastated that were created or grown using borrowed money. So that's absolutely devastating to a small farmer or a small business. So specialized equipment and financing, specialized knowledge, right? So that's one of the most scarce assets that you would have in this industry outside of the time and the timeline that you're on would be specialized knowledge. You need to have a farmer who knows what they're doing. You need to have different members on your team that understand how to turn the soil and understand how to raise the animals. And you can't just put an executive off the street into a farming or manufacturing situation. That would go horribly wrong. You need someone with specialized knowledge. Then there's labor, right? And then there is, well, labor, we don't need to jump on too much because you know what that is. And that's in every point along the way also. But then you have time. Already kind of gave an example of this, but if you have, I think in Eastern Washington, there are, I heard 1 billion potatoes that are, they don't have buyers for. So all of this crop was harvested and the restaurants that they would normally sell it to are not buying. So they're giving away all of these crops, all of those potatoes for the season. Because potatoes are an annual crop. They only plant them, harvest them, and store them once a year. So they're stored for the rest of the year. But there's such an excess right now. They're giving them away. And smaller farmers in Eastern Washington they had to borrow money. And they had to borrow money for the entire year, right? So you're looking at the combination between financing and time. It gets to the point where these guys will be affected now, not just next year, potentially the following year, several years out, and that's if they can stay in business. So those are all the components that go into the production process, and that's you have to have somebody in the production process that also understands the next step, because there has to be a liaison between the two, or somebody who is making sure they're selling, they understand the market and they're selling for the same cost that everyone else, or the same price that everybody else is paying. And they have developed relationships with the processors. So step two is processing. So it goes from a production facility to the processing facility, where you also need specialized knowledge and specialized equipment and specialized packaging, like what we had talked about earlier. And what goes into this also, you're going to have other ingredients, right? So you're going to have salt or other preservatives. You're going to need to combine with the raw materials as you're processing. So you have to have a relationship with another distributor or with a distributor who has the salt or other preservatives. So specialized equipment, packaging, ingredients, and the other two parts of this are, of course, time and labor. So you'll see a trend here as we're going into the next two steps after the processing. Specialized knowledge, specialized equipment, time and labor are all the most expensive components of the supply chain. All right. So if you have at any point a hiccup or a pause in production, or God forbid, you have to shut down your processing facility because there were some cases, you are absolutely devastating what you're trading those profits for when you sell the product, and that is your time. And that is the time of everybody who works for you. And that's something that you can never get back. So when we say there are secondary and third layer issues that come out of a production plant or a processing plant slamming on the brakes and stopping, it's incredibly serious because you cannot make up for that lost time. You can't do it, especially if you're over leveraged. And we'll touch on that in a little bit too. So number three in this process, you go from production. or manufacturing. Two, processing. Okay. The third is distribution. And there are three different types of distributors that I threw into the same subject or the same node on the supply chain on the journey. But I'm just going to call it all distribution. So first thing is early distribution or pre-distribution. And that's just going to be vendors. It could be something like importers. And a lot of product in the United States comes from out of the country. I gave the example of tomatoes. Those still need to be imported. Another example would be utensils and cups and lids and napkins, gloves, masks, all that stuff that the bulk of that is manufactured and exported from China and from other countries, very heavily China. But you get to a, we'll get there in a minute, but the importers are a component of the early distribution. And then you have vendors and brokers, which could be in the distribution or even the account management, relationship management section of this. But I wanted to put them here because they are finding customers or finding distributors for the processors or for the manufacturers. They kind of had their hand in a lot of different games. And they, in order to be a good broker or a good vendor, you really have to have a deep understanding of all of the players involved from the manufacturing to the, you know, selling it to the restaurant at the end. So vendors and brokers and importers, those are kind of the pre-stages. Then we have redistributors, and what redistributors are primarily is, among a lot of things, they to us primarily are warehouse space. They act as an importer as well. They have relationships with manufacturers and processors all over the world, but they are very good at being a giant 400,000 square foot redistribution center, and they can take advantage of long buys. They can pull in bulk, multiple truckloads at a time, and sit on that product for a long time. And they bake those numbers into their sale price, and that's a part of their business model, is that they can buy in bulk and they can sit on it for a long time. Or, you know, same example, they don't want to sit on it for a long time, but they built it into the pricing. So they have such good buying power and such good relationships with manufacturers all over the world that they can buy in multiple pallets or truckloads or portions of ships, of carriers that are bringing stuff. A lot of that will be allocated. A lot of that room and real estate on those ships will be allocated. Containers, I should say, will be allocated to the same redistributors who have that warehouse space. So because the manufacturers or, you know, the brokers or vendors over there will know that they have a standing order lined up, they're going to give them the best deal out of anybody else. So they, redistributors are great for a distributor because I don't want to be sitting on product for a long time. So I will work out a deal with a redistributor to hang on to these cups or hang on to these gloves or whatever it might be. And we're going to buy one pallet at a time until your inventory is depleted. And we'll probably work out a 2%, an 8%, 10%, whatever that markup will be. That's what we pay to not have to hold on to that for a long time. They also are very good at negotiating deals, working with distributors and customers on bill backs. And they're a great component for distributors and customers of mine, like chain restaurants. Restaurants that are pulling a lot of volume, hospitals, schools, anything like that. So the next step in the distributor section of the supply chain is going to be just distributors, wholesale distributors, broadline distributors, regional, national, global. Those are the ones who actually takes the product and puts it on a truck and delivers it to the restaurant or delivers it to the hotel or the school or the hospital or wherever it is, wherever it needs to go to then be sold to the customers or the consumers. We as distributors primarily handle the relationships between the redistributors or even the manufacturers and the restaurants. So a lot of chain restaurants or a lot of single restaurants, they don't want to be going and searching for where all the bones are buried. And we know that. We know where they are because this is what we do for a living, is we try to figure out where the best deal is, where we can switch items to private label, where we can do all of that. and get the best deal and the best product to the customer, to the restaurant, to the hospital, to the school. We like to manage a lot of this ourselves because we can cut back on cost of freight. And a lot of us have logistics departments that are internal because we like to handle that as well. We handle procurement, and there needs to be somebody who understands, or multiple departments who understand every step of the supply chain along the way. So distributors do a lot from that perspective. But of course, me being a distributor and being on this side of the business for so long, I'm going to say, you know, we do a lot, but every single piece of this chain does so much. So again, I can't stress this enough. When one goes down for even a week, it has this butterfly effect, this chain reaction that disrupts every other piece of the supply chain. So that's distributor. The fourth step, and the fourth piece, the last piece, is going to be the what I call the retailer, or the grocery store, or the restaurant. So chances are, if you're listening to this, you probably own or work at a restaurant, or work as a distributor. But that would be you as a restaurant. You're the retailer, and what you do, aside from a million things all at once, is you sell the product that the distributor sells you. You sell that along with other ingredients to the consumer, to the end user, to the person who is going to take it home and eat it, or eat it on site. So those are the four steps: the production, the processing, the distribution, and the retailer. It's really important to note that each step of the way, there needs to be several components, right? So there has to be a point of contact. Somebody who understands the transaction, has a specialized, has some sort of specialized knowledge. There needs to be in between the manufacturer and the processor. I don't need to drill this home anymore, but there always needs to be two people on both sides of the transaction that understand the other person's business model, what makes them successful, what makes their competitors successful, and all of that. So you have to have so much individual specialized knowledge all along the way throughout this. Every step of the way, also, there needs to be somebody planning it. And that usually is in the form of somebody who understands logistics, somebody who understands freight. And if you have somebody on the manufacturing side who understands the logistics behind dropping off raw materials at each of the processors, or at each of the redistributors or distributors, you are going to be worlds ahead of somebody who doesn't, because the cost of fuel, the cost of labor, somebody with a CDL is going to be expensive to hire and to retain. So you want to maximize, especially if they have a limit of only being able to drive 10 hours at a time. You're going to have only so many stops that they can go, and you want to maximize that as much as possible. So you would want to work logistics and freight into every aspect of delivering that product, and that goes for every piece of the supply chain. All right. This kind of ties in, but transportation and logistics are two separate things. Transportation, you actually are moving the product from A to B. So logistics and freight are one thing. You have to think about it in pre-planning, and then transportation is actually executing. So you have to have somebody who is physically transporting the product all along every step of the way here. And in between each step and for each step, you have to have the finance component, right? You have to have somebody who understands finance, understands accounting, who's going to be able to make sure that the assets and liabilities are evening out, and that you're going to be able to manage your business and manage the flow of product going from your business to another, or from another business to your business. Right, so the goods, they always flow downstream in the supply chain, and the money, or the currency, it always is going to flow upstream. So I did that yesterday. I've actually recorded this twice. I knocked my mic yesterday and muted it about 11 minutes into a 40 minute rip, and I was very frustrated with it. But I'm gonna keep rocking here. All right. So the finance piece, you need somebody who understands all those components. One important thing to note here is that there needs to be dollars switching hands. So when you look at a dollar, when you look at a peso, or any form of currency, that is 50% of every transaction, ever made in the world, right? So where we don't barter. Well, I should say 99.9% of all transactions involve money or involve currency. We're not really on any sort of a bartering system anymore. So money is 50% of every transaction. So there has to be a specialized knowledge surrounding that too. Make sure that you're running your business efficiently and effectively and profitably. Okay, so those are the components that are in between each step. Needs all of those things. Points of contact with specialized knowledge, logistics and freight, transportation and finance. And if at any point during this whole the whole supply chain, there's any sort of slowdown, every single other piece is affected, right? So that's pretty much a good rundown. I'm going to give a whiteboard example of a flow through that I'll put at the end of this video, so you can kind of see how everything flows through from beginning to end in a picture. I haven't drawn it yet. I'm sure it's going to be okay. And something that I want you to take away from this video, if you're trying to understand how the supply chain works and what just happened with this pandemic scare or with this pandemic, why did it shut down entire economies? And why is the chairman of Tyson saying that the supply chain is broken? We shouldn't be in a position that 1 week or 2 weeks, and mind you, these announcements were made right as the quarantine order was put into effect. So within the week, there were people saying, supply chain's broken, everything's broken, we need to shut down the economy, we need to start bailing out big companies, and we should not ever be in that position as a country or just as a world. And I want you to take away from this, how do you want to conduct your business and conduct yourself? Do you want to be in that same situation where if your supply is shut off for a week, you're out of business and you have to get rid of all of your employees? Or do you want to have a little bit more resiliency? And what that means, we've taken efficiency and profitability over resiliency every step of the way in building the supply chain. It makes sense with some food items, but many food items that we can keep for longer without them going bad, we do not need to be as efficient, or we do not need to set ourselves up that if it's not as sufficient, we're out of business. So what that means from a business owner's perspective or a distributor's perspective, or even as an individual's perspective, is if you are in a really challenging position right now, and you did have to let go of some of your employees, or you just left your job and you now are unable to, or lost your job and you're unable to pay rent or something like that. First, it's a very serious situation, and I can't imagine just how much worse this is going to get over the next few weeks and months. It really will. I think our unemployment rate was getting up towards 20%, something like that, which is absolutely insane. Real unemployment rate is somewhere around 20%, which is absolutely astounding. But how to not get into that situation, or how to look at this and say, I will never be in this situation again, is just don't be overextended. Have cash on hand. It's okay to have cash on hand and to not have that in markets trying to get more profitable, or in equipment trying to bet on future productivity for current returns, right? So you don't want to be over leveraged. Don't want to be overextended so far that you have only debt to your name and no assets. So it's okay to have some cash on hand. It might take some time to build that up, and it might mean that you're expanding slower than a competitor, or slower than you would like to, but you want to have some sort of protection so that you are not completely gutted when something like this happens. So you want to be able to weather storms. That's all I'll say on that. That's it. That's the rundown. I'm going to go and write on a whiteboard and put the clip up here. But since I'm signing off, what I'm going to do is a recommended video right here. And you can subscribe to the page right here and call your mother. All right. Happy Mother's Day, everybody. Have a great rest of your Sunday and a great week. And talk to you later. Bye.